your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Honey, the power's out.
Flashlight's dead. Can't find batteries.
Hey, neighbors. Want to borrow my Star Patrol spotlight?
That flashlight lights up the whole house.
Watch. The Star Patrol can light up the whole neighborhood. It can illuminate up to a half mile away.
A half mile? That's insanely bright.
And the Turbo Boost increases brightness up to 100%.
Whoa, now that's insanely bright.
With 10 illumination modes, the Star Patrol is a flashlight, spotlight, floodlight, emergency light, and more. And with an ultra-fast USB power bank, you can even charge your phone with it. Plus, the Star Patrol is fully rechargeable and backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
So how do I get one of these Star Patrols?
Go to GetStarPatrol.com and you'll get it with free Turbo Boost, free shipping, and a money-back guarantee. Again, that's GetStarPatrol.com. GetStarPatrol.com.
I'm Andrew Zucker, the host of The Golden Age with Andrew Zucker, a weekly podcast where I sit down with people who are shaping our world today at the intersection of politics, culture, and media. I've been covering this intersection as a contributing editor at Town & Country and freelance writer for outlets like The New York Times, Washington Post, and Vanity Fair. The Golden Age gives you a front row seat to the discussions that are defining our moment, whether it's talking about conservative dating apps or learning more about JFK Jr. New podcast episodes drop every week on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Subscribe now because the conversations we're having today are the ones that will define tomorrow. This is The Golden Age with Andrew Zucker. Join the conversation.
And welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. And do we have a show for you this week? Bring in the dogs and children. Tell the neighbors. Our guests are the former mayor of Chicago and Democratic Party thought leader Rahm Emanuel and Iowa gubernatorial candidate Rob Sands to talk about a special election this week. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now, we'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our recent sponsors and our past episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them. It really helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, each week we talk about Trump's excesses and lawlessness, but we talk about the particulars and we understate sometimes the overall picture. He is currently sending troops into American cities under the guise of fighting crime while cutting law enforcement assistance, seeking to control the Federal Reserve Board, which has for 100 years been independent, with specious charges against the woman on the board. He's using mortgage reviews as a weapon to go after Trump's enemies, look for tax returns to be next. He's trying to rig the elections. He has a Justice Department that's a puppet for the president. Venomous attacks on the courts that dare defy him. Going after the media, law firm, and universities. Taking control of the military, firing the best officers, and politicizing West Point and Annapolis. And as historian Sean Wilentz told our colleague Tom Ensel, Trump also is building a, quote, international crime and corruption syndicate. One of the smartest and most serious men that I know, who served in high positions in both Democratic and Republican administrations, offers a frightening parallel. Quote, this looks like Germany, 1935, end quote. James, I think that's the case, and I think there is an existential threat right now, and anyone who doesn't treat it that way is making a colossal mistake.
Well,
Of course, what you said, Albert, is very alarming. I have more alarming news. It is only going to get worse. Understand that. This is a moving bow. This man is surrounded. The walls are closing in on him. It's evident that there's something physically, I don't know, not right. They keep trying to hide it. He had a literally breakdown in a 3 hour and 16 minute cabinet meeting, if you want to call it that. And he's going to continue to get worse. He's going to start to send troops to Chicago. And he's going to do things that we cannot imagine. And I'm not being a Cassandra here at all. And what we have to do every week on this show is alert people to it. And somebody's going to have to come up with some kind of way to push this back, because it is just getting started. However bad he is today, he's going to do nothing but get significantly worse. And his mental breakdown, we're watching it unfold right in front of us.
Yeah. James, it is absolutely frightening. Let me just take one example here. This is the mortgage fraud allegations, which are just allegations and may not be relevant. But what's really alarming here, and I would encourage everybody out there to try to go get a piece that a Georgetown law professor, Adam Levitin, wrote about Bill Pulte, who was the head of the housing administration, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a Trump hack, his enemies list. What Pulte is doing is going and pulling out mortgages that may have transpired years ago of Trump's enemies, or people Trump wants to get rid of, to try to find something. That is absolutely outrageous. I think it might even be illegal. And I think, as Levitin says, it should be a fireable offense, or he should resign. Now, I think the fight with the Fed is incredibly important. I mean, James, I remember when Alan Greenspan went to Little Rock in December of 1992, and he didn't know Clinton, really, and he came back and he told me, he said, he's really smart. I'm not surprised by that. You know, he knows more than average about economics. I'm not surprised about that. What's surprising was he really understood the importance of the independence of the Federal Reserve System in our economy, whether you always agree with it or not. They make mistakes. But if the Federal Reserve is controlled by a president like Trump, it's going to be a disaster for the economy. It was last tried, not to this extent, by Nixon in 1992, and the results were catastrophic. And what Trump is trying to do here now is something I have no idea why these Wall Street titans, I know they love their tax cuts and they hope the market will go up, but this is undercutting the rule of law. It's undercutting the independence of an important institution, and I haven't heard much at all from them.
All right, we have to know where we are now. All right, when it comes to Donald Trump or Republicans, there is no rule of law. Don't kid yourself. The only way that you can have a rule of law is for it to be enforced. So you would need a Justice Department to say this is illegal. Well, you're never going to have that. You would need a Supreme Court that actually cares about the rule of law. You do not have that, people. The Supreme Court is an adjunct of the Executive Committee of the Republican Party of Northern Alabama. So there is no, when it comes to Trump, they've already said the law doesn't apply to him. And it comes to anything else, you live in a lawless country. Now, does that mean that your sorry ass better follow the law, because they'll throw you under the jail? However, if you're with Trump, we live in a lawless country. We don't have a Department of Justice that enforces these laws, and we don't have a Supreme Court that would allow these laws to be enforced. You have to understand that. The entire experiment that we started is in jeopardy. It's on the ropes. We have no law. We have no enforcement. We have no court system at the Supreme Court level, period.
Yeah, there actually is, I think, some very good judges at the appellate court, and particularly, federal district judges. This week, a couple of them, Trump appointees,
There's one in Virginia, I think his name is Judge Cullen, looked at the question of Trump trying to get rid of all the judges in Maryland, or at least, you know, just make sure they can't render any decisions. And he, Cullen, issued a blistering opinion on what a unconscionable, unconstitutional attack this was. But then it goes up to the Supreme Court, which says, oh, you know, I'm sorry, you can't interfere with Mr. Trump. If all those decisions giving him the right to do all sorts of things, if Joe Biden had been the president and asked for the same thing, do you think there's any way those Republicans would have voted for it? Absolutely not.
Sure, they're superb jurists at the district court level, at the Court of Appeals, superb state court judges and appellate judges and Supreme Court judges around this country. Some of them are not Democrats. I'd be personally. The Supreme Court is what I'm talking about. Okay.
Yep.
And I'm talking about like Brett Kavanaugh, who was the greatest leaker there was during the Ken Starr show. People forget, because we don't want to remember Ken Starr, that Brett Kavanaugh was his butt boy. All right. We don't even want to talk about the ethics of the Clarence Thomas. We don't talk about Gorsuch, who just happened to have a seat on an airplane to go to, or was it Alito? I guess it was Alito that went on a high-end fishing trip because G5 had an extra seat.
You know something? Hey, James, it was a Friday afternoon, and they looked around, and they said, hey, we got an extra seat. Anybody want it? And somebody said, you know, check with Sam.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Sam, they might have. I mean, it's so tragic. It's so, in. How do we get through it with this court? I don't know. I just don't know. But I do know that anybody that we don't have a Justice Department that will enforce the law, we have a Supreme Court that could give a shit what the law says. And yeah, we got some dedicated, you know, FBI agents, and they're probably most of them been fired or curtailed or investigating something that Harry Truman did, God knows what. So the nation is in distress. It's extreme distress, and all I can think of is we got to hoist the Jolly Roger and set sail and try to.
No, I think that's right. In this law and order president, you alluded to this, they have gone and they took all of those criminals who staged an insurrection at the Capitol, beat up and even killed some police officers. It's there. I mean, you know, it's not a case of, you know, they're accused that. You can see it. And they pardoned every one of them, and showing total contempt for those police officers who tried to defend the country and the Congress from that mob. But they claim they're a law and order president. I in Washington, I know, look, crime is coming down. It's too high. And in places you need more police, you don't need National Guard. You don't need military who are not trained for this. And you don't need Park Service patrols. But this guy doesn't care. All he cares about is demagoguing an issue and claiming that he is the savior. And it's he gets away with it.
So let's talk 1 minute about crime messaging in the Democratic Party. Remind everybody in the spring of 2021, I urge the Democrats to own this issue. The crime rate in 2024, the last year of the Biden presidency, was, I think, the lowest it's been this century. So he takes it up and he says that, and of course the answer is, the advice is 100%. Look, crime's an issue. Democrats are not very strong on that. You eat it twice. Well, what happened when we passed the crime bill in the early 90s? Joe Biden and Bill Clinton, with the largest drop in violent crime in the history of the United States. By the way, we didn't have assault weapons from 1994 to 2004. And under the last year of Biden, crime was at an all-time low. The approach I would suggest is some of these policies are working. Let's look at them and let's double down on what's working and let's forget about what's not working. And remember, a big part of the 94 crime bill was funds for 100,000 more policemen. I cannot tell you the number of mayors that I ran into that say that's the biggest thing we could got. We could hire more cops. And we're going to do that. But I'm just saying, Albert, from the start of it, we're doing some things that are working. How do we make them work better? Why do we want to go back to the crime rate we had in the whoever, some Republican administration? Let's build on the success we're starting to see. That's just the way that I would approach it. And of course, they could have highlighted it, and Harris could have highlighted it early in her term as vice president. And I know for a fact, they said, well, we just can't do that. Okay, well, you didn't do it, and look where we are in the goddamn ditch.
Yep. Same with immigration.
Right.
Same exactly.
Right.
There were consensus on immigration, and the consensus was we will have a tough border, we will have a tight border, and we will try to create a pathway to citizenship to people who are here. Most Americans supported that. Most members of Congress supported that, and it was blocked by right-wing Republicans, and then the Biden administration threw it away with the border. It's just, it's tragic. James, we try to close our chit-chat most weeks looking at Trump's promise that he would lick inflation on day one, remember? I mean, he was going to, the cost of living from day one. So today, let's take, you know, one commodity, coffee. Coffee is up by double digits since Trump took office. Now, that's due in part to the weather and supply chain issues, but it's also due to his stupid 50% tariff on Brazil because they aren't being nice to the thuggish former president who is a Trump pal. So you coffee drinkers in the morning, I would guess that's most of you, and some of you may go to Starbucks or other places. Your cost is going up, and you can thank Donald Trump for that.
So I want to put in, I've talked to a couple of Democrat consultants to talk about the hamburger. Everybody loves hamburgers, okay? Talk about what's happened to the cost of ground beef, what's happened to the cost of lettuce. But we're just typical people here, okay? We like lettuce, tomato, onion, pickle. You know, in the South, we put mayo on it, but it doesn't matter. And just break down, this is what the cost in that hamburger was on June the 20th of the year 2025. This is the cost of that hamburger on September 20th, 2025. Reduce it to the most simple thing that you can. So, well, maybe you can go meatless. Well, goddamn, the produce is still too exciting. But maybe you can do this. You know, that's the choice you have. And by the way, wouldn't it tell you, well, if you can't afford steak, eat a hamburger. Well, hamburger's now $6 a pound. But no one's even trying to eat a T-bone now or a slice of tomato. Are you kidding me? Our grandchildren will be asking about what does a tomato look like.
James, I don't understand it because I really thought that on January 21st, we'll give him a day, that right after he ended the war in Ukraine, remember that was going to happen on day one, too, Trump was going to go and end the cost of living problem. I mean, am I misremembering that? Is that just a figment of my imagination?
You're not misremembering it. And I'll tell you a good way to sneak the cost of living into everyday messaging. Of course, we, and a lot of people that are part of the commentary tend to be more fluent. And you know, but we're covering the hell out of this redistricting because it's unprecedented, it's everything. And of course, the Newsom is 100% right. California's got to do something. But what we need to say is we would prefer to be talking about how to help people deal with the cost of living. We're only doing this not because we want to, but because for the first time in American history, a president in mid-decade is saying we have to do this. The public doesn't much like it. I agree. But the reason that we really didn't want to do this is we would like to focus our attention on families and how we can help them deal with the cost of living. But our opponents won't allow us to do that. they want to shut this down with this idiotic, terrible public policy that we don't want to do, but we have to do it. But what we really want to do is help people deal with the cost of living. Just shift it.
Yeah.
Everything. Shift it. Shift it. Pivot, hit. Pivot, hit. Hit them on the cost of living. When it bring up redistrict, we'd rather not be doing this. Okay? But they give us no choice. This is what they show all day, every day, is figuring out how to hold on to power as long as they possibly can. And every day, you're trying to figure out how you're going to pay for the basic necessities in life. Frame the fucking issue.
Yeah. Amen. Because it is there, and it is there, and people all over the country are feeling it.
Oh, by the way,
every...
Albert, wasn't he going to get prices down on day one?
Oh, yeah, that's what he was going to do. That's, you know, well, I'm not sure which came first on day one, ending the war in Ukraine or solving the cost of living problem. I'm not quite sure what the order was, but at a minimum, ending any cost of living problems was number two on day one. And I guess we're now, what, day 220? Look,
God created the earth and the universe in 6 days. It looks like you could probably do something about cost of living in the 6 months you've been in. But
well, if you listen to that 3-hour cabinet meeting the other day, God has a rival. I mean, you know,
cabinet meeting was about people. How much of that cabinet meeting talked about cost of living? How much of that talked about how to counter Russian criminality in Ukraine? How much of that cabinet meeting talked about the gun violence we have in this country? I'm just watching the break on the TV in the distance. Some asshole in Minneapolis shot up a Catholic school.
James, I had to take a break for a couple minutes during that. And I guess I just missed the cabinet discussion of Medicaid and healthcare cost. Because it just, and I'm sure that J.D. Vance or Bobby Kennedy or something, they must have brought that up, didn't they?
Yeah, I'm sure that some suck-ass cabinet member said, sir, with your powers and your brilliance and the brilliance of the people in this room, I am certain, sir, that we can start getting these prices down and help people do it. No, I didn't hear that.
I didn't watch them all, and the contest was really intense.
This Republican town hall meet the voter thing that we're going through, I don't think these people are going to be able to go out in public. I think there's huge number of them that are just not going to go out to dinner. Because I think there's a pissed offness in this country, and it is just not coming from lefties as much as they want you to believe that. I think it's organic, and we're going to talk about it a little bit more later in the show.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. Hey, James, our guest is a former member of Congress, a former White House chief of staff, a former mayor of Chicago, a former ambassador to Japan, and a former really smart Democrat, Rahm Emanuel. So, Rahm, it is great to have you on here. You're in Chicago, which is very much in the news these days. You've criticized Trump's threats to send federal forces into your city, noting this has nothing to do with crime. This is about politics. But if he goes ahead and does it, and I think he's likely to, what should the state and city do?
Well, a couple things. I also, before we get to what they should do, you got to set the ground right. And I think it's really important for both the city, but also as an example to other cities and other governors, other mayors and governors, we have a crime agenda. Putting more cops on the beat, getting kids, guns, and gangs off the street. Partner with us so we can keep this momentum going and focus on what needs to be done, which is specifically around carjackings, get us the technology, be that partner in that effort. There's a legal case, be clear. There's a legal case that we can make that they don't have the right and the capacity and the authority to do this. But fighting crime is a priority, and here are the resources. And I would be very specific. Help us, rather than spend the money on National Guard, help us recruit more officers so there's permanent police presence, not temporary, with the National Guard. Help us buy the license plate readers so we can deal with carjackings and these thugs who are stealing cars. And then here's what we need to see in prosecuting gangs and guns and the violence in the city. And here's what we need to see in after-school programs. Be very specific about the program, one thing per category, and see, be a partner, ready to work it, ready to make Chicago an example of fighting crime. But National Guard for 1 week, sitting at Buckingham Fountain rather than down in Bronzeville, ain't going to fight crime.
Yeah,
it's all performative. We want performance.
Well, you're absolutely right. And take some of that excessive ICE appropriations that just took place and give it to cities to hire more cops. That has worked in the past. Now, look, this is phony. It's a terrible abuse of power. And crime is coming down in Washington and Baltimore and Chicago, but it's still awfully high. And the White House says, hey, fine, you know, complain about what we're doing. Trump is going to win this politically.
Well, Al, what I've said before many times, nobody walks around and goes, I feel 22% safer this year than I did last year. It's a sense of safety. No city, even with declining numbers, thinks public safety is resolved or solved.
Right.
So be clear you have an agenda on not only how to win this battle on crime, but where the government can be a partner. Don't shut them, invite them, but to invest in your strategy. And I think I'm not against the legal case. I'm for the legal case. But don't make that the strategy. It's a tactic. Make the strategy. Here's what we're doing on fighting crime. Help us build on this momentum so we can see even greater progress. But be very specific.
Trump would love for you to, for Chicago to make it primarily about the legal case. I mean, that's playing right into his hand.
I'm not against the legal case.
Yeah.
But we're about to make it the primary strategy.
Yeah.
Rather than ancillary to the crime strategy.
Let me turn to your party, which you've talked a lot about. And many Democrats have complained that the party has been too passive in responding to the Trump really existential threat. Gavin Newsom and recently your friend, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, have been much more aggressive. Newsom not only attacks Trump as an authoritarian, a dictator, but makes fun of him. What's your take on whether this approach is the one Democrats should be taking?
One thing I want to say that I think is important on the latter subject, which is the National Guard is as stupid and dumb as defunding the police. Both are failed policies and both are failed politics. That's my view. And I think, Al, people with the, you know, Gavin Newsom's doing what he's doing. JB's doing what he's doing. I happen to think there's a common thread between the redistricting and the National Guard. They're both about diversion and division. And the president said it about the Democrats are going to lose the politics on crime. This is not about fighting crime. This is about creating politics. He said it up front. So it is a political argument. We better be smart about it. There's some politics to just fighting Donald Trump. There's also another set of politics to fighting Trump, but offering our alternative. We have something to say on fighting crime. We're actually successful. I mean, James and I have talked about this before. You want to talk about crime? Let's go. We're ready because we're actually the ones reducing gun violence. We're actually the ones reducing burglaries and theft. Invest in what we're doing so we can accelerate it rather than having this fought off in the courts. That's what I would
say. And the Republicans actually have cut aid to law enforcement in cities while sending in the National Guard.
Not only are they're sending in the National Guard, but they're not going to go to Englewood. They're not going to go to Lawndale. They're going to sit downtown, and it's going to be performative, not performance-driven.
Well, I can tell you, living in Washington, the Washington Monument.
Are we losing Jay? Is James going to sleep?
No,
here?
I don't. No. James, you're still with us.
Right here. Right here.
No, Rom, I want to assure you, I live in Washington, and the Washington Monument is very safe these days. There's no crime. And that's what you're talking about.
How's Anacostia doing?
Yeah, no, right. They go there for press conferences. Look.
That's my point.
Overall message is from Republicans, the Democrats are weak and woke. a message of you, of other leading Democrats, Beshear, Alyssa Slotkin, even Gavin Newsom now. If you should decide to seek the presidential nomination, you said you're considering, haven't decided certainly, what would Rahm Emanuel bring to the table that others don't have?
Well, a couple things. One, Al, you and I have known each other for years. You never walk away from a meeting saying, or a conversation saying, what's Rahm's position? I'm honest. I tell you exactly what's on my mind, why I think this is the right argument. I don't have, you know, this idea that some Democrats would say we have to work on being authentic. Well, if you have to work on being authentic, breaking news, it's not authentic. Mm-hmm. And I've had the strength to take on the most powerful interests that in the country. When it came to taking on the NRA for assault weapon ban and Brady Bill, Rahm got the ball, Rahm got the call. When it came to taking on the pharmaceutical industry on opiates, first city to sue them ever, I got the call and I got the ball. When it came to taking on the insurance companies for 10 million children to get health insurance that didn't have it, I got the call and I got the ball. When it came to taking on the banks and the financial industry, I got the call and I got the ball. And you go down the list, a proven fighter. And I do think, and I've taken on powerful interest in our party when I thought, like, when you had the shorter school day and the shorter school year in the United States of America, of any city, I was willing to stand up for the kids rather than have them roll over. I created full-day pre-K and free community college. And so that's a record and an experience, and I'm willing to talk about whether you want to talk about the first island chain in Indo-Pacific or how to make sure that we don't lose focus on education. And the other piece of it is created a business environment, economic environment, where the city of Chicago for 7 consecutive years led the country in corporate relocations and foreign direct investment. But the most important things from assault weapon ban, to healthcare for children, to fighting the banks when you lost your home, to making sure that the insurance companies did not determine your kids or your family's healthcare, or taking on big tobacco. I have never backed down against a fight, and I have won those fights.
All right, James, you take the ball.
Thank you. So, bro, everybody.
He's away, Rahm.
No, I love when James shows impatience. It's like what? It's one of the great, like watching somebody just kind of like deal with their meds that just drop off. Okay, go.
Okay. Other than President Clinton and Senator Joe Biden, you had more to do with the 1994 crime bill than anyone else. Now, this is considered by the smart people as, oh, it was nothing. It was midnight basketball. It was performative, you know, art by the Clinton administration. Then you listen to the far left people to say it was a disaster. It you know, we have to do something. Was the 1994 crime bill a success? And if it was, why?
Okay. As I always say, people, take 1984 to 1994 and 1994 to 2004. Which set of crime data do you want? Okay, it's very simple. We can go back to 1984 to 1994 when people were fleeing cities, people putting double locks on their front door, and crime was on a trajectory where people thought it was going to be a permanent factor of our lives. In the 10 years following the 1994 crime bill, gun violence, crime, other types of property thefts, burglaries, robberies, all declined. Number two, it was built on the strategy I outlined a little earlier, James, putting more police on the street, getting kids, guns, and gangs off the street. 100,000 community police officers funded there doing community policing had an impact on gun violence. The data shows it. Number two, as somebody who's invested a huge amount of money when I was mayor, after school, summer jobs, mentoring programs, keep kids off the streets and growing and developing appropriately. Number three, you commit gun violence and crime, you're going to get the law to follow you wherever you go. And prosecuting criminals for crimes, violent crimes specifically, should be the focus of both state and federal prosecutors. So to me, it worked because we invested in a strategy of putting more cops on the beat, doing community policing, and getting both kids, guns, and gangs off the street, and return those streets to the residents of that neighborhood, not to the gangbangers to own. And that's what worked. But it's a simple fact. Compare where date crime was and the trajectory in 1984, 10 years before the 1994 bill, and compare it to 2004, those same data points. Now, was it a perfect bill? Let me say this. It wasn't perfect. It's part of the legislative process. Okay? It's not a perfect bill.
Are you telling me that crime in the last 4 years of the Clinton administration was lower in the last 4 years of the Reagan administration? Is that what you're trying to tell us? Because everybody knows Reagan was tough on crime. When it came to crime, Clinton was a pussy, right? Let's look at the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, that's why there's a degenerative gene in Democrats who are saying, let's not talk about this. Let's just, or be quiet about quote unquote or crime or immigration or something. No, we're not only going to talk about it because this is my point about how to confront Trump. I'm for the case, but that's a tactic and a strategy. We can't lose this argument about crime. And we have something to say. We're actually seeing Baltimore to a 1968 low in homicides. Invest in what we're doing that's working so we can pick up the momentum and really drag this. Help us deal with carjacking. It is a persistent problem that is lagging as opposed to robberies, burglaries, or shootings. And we actually are making progress. And rather than the federal government being a problem, be a partner in solving it. And everything that the president's doing is performative. We want to be performance-based.
Back to you, but am I crazy to hear somebody at the DNC meeting in Minneapolis said carjacking is not a problem? I swear I heard that.
I did not.
I don't know.
I didn't hear that. So I can't comment on it.
It's a big problem if you live in New Orleans or Chicago.
Listen. But actually, I don't mean to, I wouldn't want facts to get in the way.
Right.
The shootings and homicides, the burglaries and thefts are declining, and the pace of the decline has picked up. The area that is most persistent or most difficult in cracking is carjacking. Now, we had this problem when I was mayor towards the end. We hired these license plate readers so you can instantaneously know if that car was stolen and you can pull it over. And we then saw a precipitous decline. Cities need the resources both to not only hire cops, which I'm for, rather than National Guard, but then invest in giving the ability of police departments to get this instantaneous carjacking to deal with car theft. It is a problem. And my other rule, people don't like their home invasion and they don't like their car invasion. And you better get close to being on the side of protecting them in both, straight up.
All right, man, you got the call and you got the ball. You ran with it, I'll tell you that.
No, but listen, James, you remember this because I remember the day before the vote you called me. I was responsible for the passing the Brady Bill and the assault weapon ban in 1994, and passing the crime bill. 100,000 community police officers doing community policing, trained to do community, worked, giving kids an alternative to the street with after-school summer jobs. Worked keeping them off the streets with an adult who gave them athletic, artistic, and academic activities, and prosecuting both gangs and gun criminals. Worked. And the data, and I don't mean to go to this, but you could have 1984 crime numbers or you could have 2004, the decade before, the decade after. It said that don't take a PhD and you don't need to write your doctoral thesis.
In other words,
James, you know who the harshest critics of the crime bill are?
Who? Well, Black Caucus voted unanimously for it.
The Black mayors led the effort. Go look at what Maynard Jackson said when he was mayor of Atlanta. Go look at the mayor of Detroit this night. The fact though, the progressive left, which is hated that bill, and as I said, defunding the police is as dumb or dumber than the National Guard. Both are in competition for the dumber category.
Absolutely. Thank you, man. Go ahead, Albert.
Rahm, you were in Japan as our ambassador, but because you're Rahm Emanuel and everything you've done, you talked to the White House more than most ambassadors during that time. And I think you also talked to Biden on occasion. Did you ever see any signs of a slipping mental acuity from the president or ever talk to his aides about whether he should not run in 2024?
Well, as you know, I have a practice. You don't talk about your engagements with the president. I hadn't done them about Clinton. I hadn't done them about Obama. I'm not doing them about Biden. But as you well know, Al, there's nothing around this face has ever been subtle. I've told people my view. I was 8,000 miles away and 12 hours away. I also worked next to Vice President Joe Biden. Our offices were next to each other. The assault weapon ban and the Brady Bill and the Violence Against Women Act that Al talked about earlier, just in the earlier section, that's how I got to know Senator Joe Biden, because I was the point person in the White House. He was a different person in each of those stages of his life. But I'm a very direct person.
Well, then, were you direct in telling them he should not run or raising that possibility?
Al, again, I don't talk about what I say to presidents, otherwise that's your last conversations. But as it relates to the White House and is written in the book that Jake Tapper has, my views well known.
In New York, you are very anti-Mondami, the socialist who won the Democratic primary. Would New Yorkers be better off with Andrew Cuomo as mayor?
You say I'm anti.
But you said he wasn't your kind of Democrat.
Well, I think his critique is right. It's why I think, as I've said 100 times, our focus should be restoring confidence in the accessibility of the American dream. It's unaffordable right. And it's inaccessible, and that has to be unacceptable. Us owning a home, saving for your retirement, saving his education, and not being one sickness away from the poorhouse. Okay? His critique of the system and the struggles people go on. You used to attain a middle-class life, now you struggle to stay in it. Big difference. I don't agree with his prescription. And I will say, take his desire for the city owning grocery stores. I made a big dent as mayor in food deserts. I brought all the big grocers around, and we came to a conclusion after a full-day conference locked in a room. If you had a 5-year plan and 8 groceries that you were going to open, you got to have something inside a food desert, and I'll treat all 8 of those as a single application. I'll save you time, I'll save you money, I'll save your resources. And that's how we made real progress in eliminating food deserts. The city of New York will not run 5 grocery stores. But the challenge on affordability, accessibility, especially in struggling neighborhoods, is a real issue. There's an alternative route. In the same way that when we were rebuilding the entire red line on the south side of Chicago, all 12 miles, for the 4.5 months it was done, I gave free bus rides. But when it was under construction, the moment it was built and up and running, it ended. There's a way to address that issue that he's brought up. But I don't think his answer to these problems is right, his critique of the problem. And I don't think when you look at the rest of the country, outside of Manhattan and outside of New York City, that the way to win elections is with a socialist message or messenger. I don't.
So you do think Andrew Cuomo would be better?
We have a slightly struggled, challenging relationship in history.
A lot of people do.
Yeah. Okay. Some people may have it with me.
No.
So
no.
I'm not. But let me say one thing. I come from the view for Democrats to win nationally and in states and in districts, we have to pick the lock electorally. The system is not level across. And so you have to have both the right messenger, the right message, and the right capacity to deliver it. I think a lot of people, look how cool he is on TikTok, et cetera. They think it's all fairy dust. He had a good message against the right type of opponents for him. I don't think, though, what happens in Upper West Side of Manhattan is indicative of how you want to go work in the upper peninsula of Michigan or the upper peninsula area of Wisconsin. Not that it is an upper peninsula, but the far north. I don't.
James, I don't think Rahm has a candidate in this race. Let me ask you.
No, but I do. But Al, here's my. I get why you're asking me about there. As somebody that you guys know this, somebody that recruited people out of the national security apparatus in 2006 that did a model that was replicated in 08, 18, 2022. We have two candidates who reflected that strategy running for governor in New Jersey and Virginia.
Absolutely.
In 2025, right. In 2 months from now. It was a very successful strategy that we replicated that allows us to get access to voters that don't vote Democrat historically to vote. And I don't think it's an accident. Take the New Jersey primary. You have five candidates, a mayor of Newark, the president of a teachers union, the mayor of New Jersey City, two members of Congress who are both moderates, and 49.8% of the vote went to the two moderates. And our nominee is a woman out of the National Security Navy.
Yeah, our helicopter pilot.
Our nominee in Virginia is a former member of the intelligence apparatus. That was the playbook that was novel in 06. And in Virginia congressional, for Jerry Connolly's seat, which happened 3 days after New York, nobody paid attention. I think it was 11 candidates. And the nominee was the one big and was the most moderate of the 11. So I actually think people don't understand where the Democratic primary voters are and also don't understand how you win in swing/marginal areas. I think New York City is not where the party is.
Well, we both totally agree with you on that. I want to find one final question, then turn it over to James. You're a big supporter of Israel. You have been for your whole life. And you're a very tough critic of Netanyahu. After the initial justified response to Hamas terrorism, he's continued this war, death of a lot of children, thousands starving. He seems to have played both Biden and Trump. Your former colleague, Adam Smith, who is the top Democrat in the House Armed Services Committee, says in order to get leverage, we ought to suspend assistance to Israel, what the Germans have done. Do you agree? Military assistance.
No. So I want to do two things. In 2009, long time before this war broke out, as chief of staff, I went toe-to-toe with the prime minister, and he publicly said I was a self-hating Jew. he said it publicly, and he goes after me in his own book. So I didn't need a war to know that he wasn't ready, that he, I thought, was steering Israel in the wrong direction. I do believe Israel has a right to self-defense, and they've exercised that. Third, as I said the other day, you're coming on the 2-year anniversary of this October 7th. When 1,200 Israelis were killed, women were raped, their fetuses were cut, children were killed in front of their parents, and parents were killed in front of their children, and 200 plus people were taken hostage. Israel has degraded and destroyed Hamas. On the 2-year anniversary with Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish holiday coming, the prime minister must decide whether those kids, the 20 that are alive, will stay in the tunnels or whether they'll be in temple. Will they be with their captors or will they be with the community? And the only reason he's putting the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, at risk for more deaths is not for degrading Hamas, not securing the state of Israel. It's for his own political security, not the security of the state of Israel. And he's put himself in front of the country. That's number one. Number two, wait, Al, back off. I'm going. Number two, since the time I arrived in Israel in June of 67, never has Israel been more strategically secure than at any other time than now. It has also never been more politically and strategically in the region vulnerable. In 67, I arrived right after I was 6 years old. I arrived right after the war. You now have peace with Egypt. You have peace with Jordan. You have quiet with Syria. You have quiet with Lebanon. The entire region around Israel, except for West Bank or Gaza, driven by a policy that has shut people off and made Israel, I think, antithetical to its own interests. I do believe in a two-state solution. Now, to your very core question, as in the room with President Obama when we debated and encouraged him to sign the funding for the Iron Dome. I do not believe you should cut off because military aid, because America gets a lot of benefit. What I have had and I proposed before, and this was the original of the fight I've had with Netanyahu and George Mitchell writes about housing on the West Bank. My view is any person involved in Israel in any violence on the West Bank or in those areas would be put on a no-fly zone to the United States. They're committing violence. It's against the interests of the United States. So I would not cut off military assistance because we gain a lot. What I would be clear is that you cannot come to the United States if you're working against a stated policy of the United States. You commit violence on the West Bank towards Palestinians and convicted of it, you'll be on a no-fly zone. I understand the spirit behind the ban. I think it's wrong directed because it adversely affects the United States. But I would be clear about my position about those who commit violence on the West Bank against Palestinians and prosecuted for that.
James Carville.
So, first of all, I really want to thank you. And something that I want our listeners to take away from this show. We talked about what happened in Sioux City, Iowa, right?
Yeah.
Big win last night. We talked about what happened in New York City, Mondain.
Yeah.
What we have to remember is they both ran on the same thing.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Remember that for everybody that comes up and says, well, it's this, and he said that, and then this and that, and how you run on the Missouri River and how you run on the Hudson River. It's the same shit, people. People can't afford to live, correct? Am I right, Ron?
No, listen, James, 100%. And the reason people are disappointed in Democrats, the reason they're down, people's backs are against the wall.
Right.
They are struggling. And they expect when they're hurt, Democrats will come help them. And we were MIA. We were on a bunch of secondary issues, making them look like they were primary to us when they were not. They were secondary to the public. And on the primary issues, affording a home, affording your health care, saving for your kids' education, not treating your 401k as a backstop to your paycheck. We were MIA. And the critique in Iowa that won, the critique in New York that won, is the same critique, which is the cost of living, the affordability, and attaining and retaining an American dream in a middle-class life is out of reach. And people get angry when you break the contract. Number two on this, and I think this is, now I'm showing my stripes in history. When Bill Clinton becomes president, we're a much more diverse party, let alone geography of where people are elected from. We had Southerners, we had rural members. Today, there's more unity among Democrats. Now, we're a smaller party with a smaller footprint. The critique in Manhattan is the critique in Iowa. The solution to that problem is where there's diversion. But we're talking about, now, some people may say, I did free community college if you got to be average. Some people will say, you shouldn't have an average choice, you should just be free. But we don't disagree with, and what we agree with, a high school education ain't enough. You got to have more. And so to me, I agree with James. The critique that won the election, same. And in the core message, and this is also true about 2024, when Kamala Harris was change and on affordability, buying a home, your first home, she was winning. When she went to democracy, is on the ballot, et cetera, she slipped. This is not rocket science. It's not he has cool TikTok. You could have cool TikTok in the wrong message. If you have the right message accentuated by TikTok or otherwise, that's the core point. And also, James, I would say beyond Iowa and New York, there's other special elections showing the same point. We're just learning the same lesson. We think it's original every time we see the same results.
Yep. Well, I think we learned a lot from, you mentioned my theory was proven today to the nth degree. There is more talent in today's Democratic Party than I've ever seen in any party at any time in my lifetime. And thank you for coming on and proving me right again.
I've had a friendship with James Carville since 1991.
There you go.
My entire life existence is to confirm to him that he's the most brilliant strategist because he has moments of insecurity in that home with his two daughters and his wife where he only calls me because he needs reassurance that he's not an idiot.
You need it sometimes too. Don't kid yourself.
My favorite thing. Yeah. Are you kidding? I call you for the moral support too.
Rom, I'll tell you this. I agree with James. You've been a great guest. And if you do decide to run for president, what better venue than Politics War Room? It's an open invitation. Wow. We're here. We're just waiting for you.
I have a couple other venues that compete with the brilliance of this podcast, just for the record. Look, I'd say one thing about these midterms. We're going to learn a lot in November, New Jersey and Virginia. And and the reason you got redistricting, midterm elections are a verdict on the incumbents. Donald Trump knows it. And that's why he's trying to rig the system, because as anybody knows what the jury's going to say, it's him. And the jury's going to come down that your policies that are not focused on affordability has made things more expensive. You have gone from being helping solve immigration to being the disorder around immigration. And the country, Democrats and independents, are ready to issue that verdict. And the president of the United States is scared. He is scared that the one big beautiful bill is already perceived before day one as a failure. His immigration policies, failure. And his own numbers, lowest he's ever been. The country's ready to turn the page.
The Trump is trying to, told that idiotic cabinet meeting he had, they need to try to change the name of the big beautiful bill because it's going over so poorly. And
yeah, I mean, hey, look, it's going over poorly because not from a marketing standpoint, because the substance sucks.
Yep.
You can't cut taxes on the wealthy and cut health care for the many. And yeah. Folks know it.
Yep.
The other thing is, it's not just health care. All these cuts in energy is leaving your utility bill rising faster than your paycheck. And people know it.
Don't forget veterans. Thank you, man.
All right, buddy. Thank you. Good. Thanks.
Hey, James, our guest is Rob Sand, who is the state auditor of Iowa. He's won two statewide elections. Not very many Democrats have done that. He is almost certainly the Democratic candidate for governor in 2026. And my dear friend Michael Gartner, who in his advanced years still has it, says he thinks that Sand's going to win. So I know you have a bunch of questions for Rob about a certain election that was held yesterday, James.
So, Rob, I want to get the most important thing out of the way. If someone is listening to this and they want to throw a shekel or two in your campaign treasury, how do they do that? What's your website, or how do they send it?
That is the most important thing, unfortunately. RobSand.com. That's the place to do it. RobSand.com.
Okay. So, Rob, we were texting yesterday and last night during this whole election. Break it down. Give us your analysis. Was this as big a win as we think it is? And if it is, why? Or if it's not, why? You're getting ready to run for governor. Of course, you dissected the thing. I hope you did.
Rob, let me just interrupt to set the stage. It was a state Senate seat in Sioux City area, which the Republicans had won by 10 or 11 points, and in a special last night, a Democratic one. So that's the scene. Go ahead.
That's right. One by 10. So I guess this is what I would say. You know, one election is one election, but this is now four special elections that we have had in the state of Iowa this year. And in every single one of them, the Democrat has overperformed by at least 20 points. That is, that makes for, I think, four of the top five overperformances in the nation this year. And let me tell you why. People are fed up here in the state of Iowa. We have had 10 years of one-party control. That is unusual for us. Most people think of Iowa as purple, as the hat and the shirt that Mr. Carville's wearing right now. and that's typically the way we think of ourselves, but they've really sort of gone off their rocker in terms of just focusing on insiders and special interest groups instead of serving Iowans. Our economy is 49th in the country. We are number one, however, for cancer growth in our education system, which, you know, we put on our quarter. If you see that Iowa State quarter, it says Foundation in Education. We're just in the middle of the pack right now, and people are just fed up. And they look around and they're like, well, what have you been doing in Des Moines? And the answer is, they literally passed a law to make it harder for our office, the state auditor's office, to find misspent money. They passed a school vouchers program that has no oversight. And they're picking on people who are different. And I think most Iowans are just looking at the situation saying, I've had enough. And so you see these repeat overperformances time after time. Now, I want to add, too, Caitlin Dre is an incredibly hardworking candidate. She got out there and she did the work. And that makes a huge difference, too. You can't win races if you're not putting up people that are going to do the work. And so she did the work and she deserves credit for that, too.
So this was Sioux City. I haven't been. Isn't there a song called Sioux City Sioux?
There is. There is.
Yeah, I gave a speech at the Chamber of Commerce some years ago, and they're very passionate about their town. And that, am I correct, is on the Missouri River, is in extreme west Iowa.
That's right, Northwest Iowa. It's I want to say it's the fifth biggest city in the state.
Okay, so let's just talk some politics here. What do you think is driving at the core that Iowa is Democrats are overperforming by 20 points or more? I mean, I've seen overperformance around the country, but the Iowa overperformance strikes me is on the high end of it.
Yeah.
What's driving this?
I think we've got a lot of really talented and passionate volunteers, boots on the ground, people who will drive up to Sioux City, if that's where the special is. They'll drive over to Clinton County, if that's where the special is. They're all here in Iowa. I'm talking about Iowans, people who are fed up with the direction of our state, and they are willing to put in the work. They're willing to put in the resources to make the difference. I think that's going to be a huge difference maker for us in November of 2026, too. I think Iowans in this state are just saying, okay, we've had 10 years of a trifecta. Enough is enough. And I think there's more and more people move in that direction, too.
All right, Albert.
One thing, Rob, about that election, and not only was great for Democrats to win one, but also for the legislature, I think with that victory, it took away the Republican supermajority, which means that all appointments can only be confirmed with at least one Democratic vote. Am I correct?
That's right. And I think that is a real difference maker. I mean, right now we have a head of the Department of Education who's never spent time employed in a classroom, and who doubled the take for the private company that is running our school vouchers program. They literally amended the contract to double the pay for this company while asking for nothing in return for taxpayers. It wasn't approved. Our office found in the auditor's office wasn't approved by the folks in middle management. It just went straight to the top, which is a violation of the standards there. And so I think it'd be great to have people who actually, you know, are qualified and are going to do the work for taxpayers as opposed to putting insiders and special interest groups first.
Rob, let me tell you my concern. And I think special elections are important. They're telling. I always believe whatever Michael Gartner tells me. I have for 50 years. But I remember being optimistic about Iowa the year before an election. But the last 10 years, this purple state, even purple slightly blue state, has gone so red that I worry this is a Prague spring. That, you know, when it comes down to the election, I thought it was going to be close in Iowa last November. I thought there was a chance to beat Ernst 6 years ago. And at the end, it seems the Republicans just get together. Why is it different now?
I would go back to the list that I gave you right when we started this conversation. Those are all things that have happened in the last couple of years, since the last midterm. Right. The school vouchers program is that new, and it is unpopular in the state of Iowa. Gut in the auditor's office happened in 2023. This is the first midterm where we can really have an opportunity to reflect on that in the governor's race, right? And again, our economy is 49th in the country. Our personal income growth is 48th in the country. I just think that Iowans are looking around and they're going, you know, look, it's it's one of those situations where you give people too much power for too long and they forget why they came here. And I think we've got more and more people recognizing that. In fact, we just had a guy who is the most recent chair of the Greene County Republican Party say that in the governor's race, he'll support me over Randy Feenstra if that's who my opponent is. Now, this is a guy who the Republican Party hired to follow me around and videotape me for a couple of years. So he knows me pretty well because he's been listening to what I've said. And all I ever did,
that was a big mistake. Rob.
But he's a guy who just, you know, he said, look, I know Sand, I've listened to him for hours on end. He's trying to do right by the whole state, and I know we'll disagree, but I look around and he sees folks in his own party that don't really show up. Meanwhile, I do a town hall in every county seat every single year. I tell the public I'm coming. We've done 40 of them this year. We got 60 more to go. And I think people are hungry for that kind of leadership. They want someone who's willing to come out and talk to them, even if it's going to be a disagreement.
Well, I know you have some strong Senate hopefuls, too, to run against Ernst if she runs. We had a terrific one on last week. You mentioned your likely Republican opponent next year.
I did not say likely. I couldn't tell you who's going to be on the other side. Okay. I was just telling you what John said about how he felt about that match.
Do you have any sense, will the Republicans run the same kind of right-wing candidates they've succeeded in running in the past 10 years?
I don't know. I mean, we'll see what happens out of this. I can tell you this. It's going to be someone that it would just continue the path that we have been going on, which is, at this point, not a popular one.
James.
Rob, let's get inside Senator Ernst's head and let's stipulate we have a lot of room, a lot of maneuver room in that head. Right? What are people, I don't know, you don't know which does, and you're running for Senate, I mean, for governor, not the Senate, but do you think this is going to affect her? Because she hasn't decided. She hasn't said she's going to run, has she?
She has not said that, no.
Most people kind of think this makes it less likely, or just don't know and don't think about it yet.
You know, I don't know. We're waking up here morning after. I know Senator Ernst. I don't know her that well. I can't claim to tell you her thinking. She doesn't run it past me. I think a wake-up call. But I don't know that it's going to be. I think a lot of the folks on the other side, again, it's just this tiny group of people that are running the state of Iowa right now. It's not the entire Republican Party. It's just these insiders.
Right.
And they're doing all this stuff that even people in their own party don't like. Guys, let me tell you a story. And I think this is just one of those crystal clear moments that tells you what's going on in the state of Iowa. So I get an invite to go do a town hall with a very conservative group. They're called the Gaza Patriots. G-A-Z-A, and like everything else in Iowa, if it's spelled the same way as something else in the world, we pronounce it differently. So the Gaza Patriots contact me. They say, would you come to a town hall with us? And this is a group that, you know, is sort of conservative enough that they don't put the word Republican in the title. And I said, absolutely. Yeah, I will. Because I'll go anywhere. I'll talk to anybody. I think that's my obligation as a candidate, as an elected official. And so I went up there as their state auditor. Al, Jim, when they announced that I was going to be there, the headquarters of the Republican Party of Iowa called them up and read them the riot act for having the gall to talk to one of their own statewide elected officials. And I know this happened because at the start of this event, where there were probably 80 people there, at the start of this event, the organizer of the event announced it to everyone who was there. That's how angry she was with the Republican establishment in the state of Iowa about the fact that they would think that they could tell her who to talk to, that they could tell her, you shouldn't talk to your state auditor. And that is just a level of arrogance and a level of entitlement that I think is incredibly unattractive to the state of Iowa, where people value public service and they value hard work. You try to tell somebody who to talk to, try to tell them who not to talk to, they're probably going to make a point of talking to them for twice as long as they were going to in the first place, just to show you who's who.
Well, that's right out of the Trump playbook. Before we let you go, Rob, I have to say we mentioned Sioux City, and this is probably before you were born or you were just a toddler. One of the great Democrats from Sioux City was the late Alan Barron, who was a legend in Washington back in the 90s. And he always talked with great fondness about Sioux City without acknowledging that it was pretty conservative. So we have a great feeling for you Iowans, and the best of luck to you, Rob.
One more thing, Rob. You mentioned Clinton County. I've actually been on a barge. I've been to Clinton, Iowa.
Excellent.
On the Mississippi River, and I've been to Quad Cities. So next year, I'm going to come campaign with you, and we're going to campaign in Clinton, Iowa.
Do it.
go to the Quad Cities. But thank you so much, and thank you for your friendship, and we'll have you back. And
hey, thank you, too.
We'll see Inauguration Day in Des Moines. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
Take care, Rob. Thank you.
Appreciate it, guys.
Hey, now for the outrage of the week. After Kamala Harris, running a mediocre campaign, suffered a cataclysmic loss to Donald Trump, there was a small positive. The campaign suggested it was debt-free. Except that wasn't true, as we learned from Shane Goldmacher's reporting in the New York Times this week. They owed $20 million, and they cut a secret deal with the Democratic National Committee to pay it off in return for her helping the committee raise money. Without telling donors, Goldmacher writes, it appears $1 in $5 the DNC raised this year went to paying off Harris campaign bills. Harris apparently has paid off now most of those debts, while the DNC is in terrible financial shape. Now, there are other factors in this. They picked the wrong chair, I think, and they're still too woke. But the good news here is, compared to the House and Senate campaign committees, the National Committee is much less important. As for Harris, she's not running for governor of California, and she sure as hell shouldn't run for president again.
So let's continue talking about the DNC. They met in Minneapolis. Shane is there. It was his reporting. I'm going to read to you something from Mediaite, which is a reliable, I think a good site. The Democratic National Committee, DNC, received criticism and ridicule Monday after it began with an indigenous land acknowledgement. DNC Chairman Ken Martin began the meeting by inviting Lindy Sowmick, S-O-W-M-I-C-K, I'm reading from here, a self-described indigenous queer woman, unquote, to acknowledge the land had been taken from the Dakota people. Good morning, DNC members, friends, and relatives. Let's talk about the land for a second, said Sowmick. The DNC acknowledges and honors Dakota Oyate, the Dakota people, original stewards of the land. Okay, lady, you're right. That land, what we did to Native Americans is really been well documented, and it is a sad part of our nation's history. Why are you bringing this up in an election? Okay, what we did, but all kinds of things with slavery, with experiment with drugs, what we did during what happened in the Confederacy during the Civil War, and Andersonville, and it's okay. This is an election, and the DNC is not the place to discuss this. Understand this: the DNC does not exist to right wrongs. It doesn't exist to acknowledge the more unpleasant parts of history. It doesn't exist to make people feel good. It exists, get this through your head, to win elections. Now, do you think that is going to help us win elections, say, like we did in Iowa, which is, I think, close to Minnesota. My geography is there. By talking about land theft from the Dakotas. We're not. Please stop this in the name of a just, merciful God. Don't you see what's happening? Don't you see where this has brought us to? For God's sakes, lady, and what is Ken Martin doing that? You don't have but one job, Ken. It's to win. No, honestly, I mean, she's probably a friend of yours from Minnesota. I'm sure she's a perfectly elegant, nice person. That has nothing to do with this. You're supposed to try to win fucking elections.
Agreed.
Before we leave this, in case you're wondering, Fox was over this like stink on shit. They were all over it, as you could well imagine.
All right, now for our questions from our really well-informed and provocative sometimes listeners. There's Dan in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. James says, should we constantly be hearing about the dangers of Trump's declining health? And he wants you to lead the charge.
Well, I think what I think is the real danger is I think, of course, like all people, us included, at a certain age start to physically deteriorate and to some extent mentally deteriorate. That's clearly happening with him. Concurrent with his obvious physical and mental deterioration and madness, his political situation is deteriorated as much as his mental and physical deterioration. And he senses that. And this makes him more dangerous every day. And I, you know, again, I was on this for a year ago, and I asked the question today, as I asked many times before, on January 17th of the year 2017, Donald John Trump sent Keith Schiller and two goons into the office of his internist in Manhattan, a man named Dr. Bornstein, and stole Trump's medical files. Dr. Bornstein, who unfortunately is now deceased, felt like he was raped. What is in those files? Now, I remember when we ran, remember Dr. Altman at the New York Times? If you didn't give him every freaking detail, all right, or if you were ever treated for venereal disease when you're in your teens, and people would just speculate on that ad nauseum, all right, what is in those medical records? And why does no one ask for? All right, they went in, this is documented, January 17th, 2017. And we don't get any straight answer about all of the splotches and discoloration, swollen ankles as big as his neck. All right, the inability to complete a sentence. If it would have been Joe Biden, Jake Tapper would have gone in and written the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, 8 volumes. All right, what is it about Trump? This show was very much calling Biden out. We don't have to apologize to anybody for anything. But why are people that we know and we respect who, you know, after the fact were very clear about Biden's cognition issues, why are they so afraid of this? I don't know.
Good question. Maybe he's afraid they'll go after their outlets. Maybe. Who knows? Steve in Australia, we'd love to hear from down under, says, can humor save us from Trump? We ought to try more of it. Yes, it's right to call him a dishonest, vicious autocrat. He is all that, and he's attacked for that. But we ought to follow his playbook and make fun of him, whatever it is. Make fun of his weight. Make fun of his malaprops. Make fun of his insecurities that everyone has to hero worship him. Gavin Newsom has started that, I think, doing it pretty well. But others ought to do more of it. There's nothing that bothers him more than ridicule. And the Democrats have done a really mediocre job in ridiculing Trump. And there's a lot to ridicule.
So, all right, the problem about making predictions as well, the predictions, and somebody comes back to laugh at you. But I'm going to come with my prediction. Watch Saturday Night Live. They're going to do this cabinet meet. I can tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Now, these guys are already walking on this.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
Let me tell you, it's going to be fucking epic. Epic.
Yeah.
Watch it.
Absolutely. James, I always give you the questions from New Orleans. This is from John. He says, what do you think about firing DNC Chair Martin and electing Stacey Abrams as chair?
You know, I don't know that I think maybe Ken Martin, maybe it's just an impossible group to lead. And if the DNC adapted one rule And it's the first rule of every physician. First, do no harm. If they just did that, that would mark a 300% improvement over what we have now. I did not ask one, some pissy art critic, what did you think of Leroy Neiman? And he said, well, frankly, I never think of Leroy Neiman. Okay, fine. That should be your attitude toward the DNC. And in Minneapolis, it just showed how hopeless it is. And I'm not sure that Ken Martin is a terrible guy. I just think it's comprised of people whose agenda is not winning elections. And we ought to just, like, pay no attention to them.
Yep.
That's all.
Chris in West Chicago, Illinois, asks, how is it that the right has co-opted the American flag to seemingly always stand for conservative or far-right ideology? Can we take it back? Chris, I would just remind that in 1989, the Supreme Court declared it was unconstitutional to ban flag burning, which is what Trump's trying to do. I mean, the notion that he has read the Constitution, much less decisions. But in that majority was none other than Anton Scalia, who said he hates the picture of anyone burning the American flag, but it is protected under the First Amendment. And that's what we are as a country. And I'm interested to see if some of these right-wing, supposedly First Amendment advocates like Jonathan Turley will go after Trump for this demagogic stand on flag burning.
Yeah, what about Dershowitz? He claims to be the man that can only speak for the First Amendment. Do Democrats, do they overuse the flag? Yeah, you know, I like symbolism too. Look at the top of my head, all right? And symbolism's good. Plus, I think we got a damn nice looking flag. I really do. It kind of makes sense, the 13 colonies, you know, the 50 states, you know, great stories. But I think they're more for the Confederate battle flag than they are for the U.S. flag, if you ask me.
Oh, yeah. They would be for banning that for sure.
You could burn a whole box of American flags. Boy, if you touch the Confederate battle, St. Andrew's Cross, or whatever they call it.
James Carey in San Diego, California, I want you to explain what would happen if Democrats force a government shutdown. It's not forced. They just wouldn't vote with the Republicans to avoid it. Could we benefit?
Yeah. I mean, they're going to blame, right now, they're going to blame the Republicans. And I think Schumer went out of his way, I think it was back in May, to prevent one. And I think, if it comes to this, but we can't force a government shutdown. We need Republican votes to do that. And so they own it. Now we're going to start owning it, you know, after the starting January 2027, but we don't own shit now.
Well, wait a minute. If it brings up, it's not under reconciliation. You're going to need, I think, more than a majority vote to keep the government open.
They might, or they could just suspend the rules if they want.
Yeah.
For Supreme Court justice, there's nothing to stop them.
Yeah,
you know, that's
they will do anything. Kyle in Charlottesville, Virginia, says, given that Trump and Republican policies are dramatically raising the cost of health care and throwing people off the health care rolls, you think Democrats should once again campaign for a public option health care plan as Biden did in 2020? Public option's fine. Medicare for all or a public health care system is a terrible mistake. But if you want to say to people, you will not lose your health plan under what we have, we're going to expand it, we're going to make it better, and we'll give you the option of a public option if you want to. I think that's good policy and good politics.
Yeah, I do too. You always got to differentiate between, of course, it's all become mushed into one question now. It's not just healthcare, it's how you pay for your healthcare. And it's becoming more and more an issue that people have because, God, anybody that ever does any campaign research or focus groups knows the most dominant observation that people make is, I'm one disease away from bankruptcy, or I'm already bankrupt because I had a disease and my kid had one. And there's no, you know, I think back of the 92, the whiteboard, Shane Durst saying the economy is stupid, don't forget healthcare. Healthcare is now an economic issue as much as it is a healthcare issue. It really is.
Yeah. James, our final question is from Arthur in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow.
My town. He's good question. Andy Beshear, he says, would make a strong presidential candidate, but shouldn't he instead concentrate on running for the U.S. Senate to replace Mitch McConnell in an effort to take back the Senate?
He should do what he wants to. Look, he's a sterling candidate. He wins by more than a little bit in a state that Republicans win by way, way more than a little bit. In a kind of big player in all of this, and his good friend of the governor is Rocky Adkins, who's a legislator from Eastern Kentucky. And I suspect that Rocky's going to be our gubernatorial or senatorial nominee, and he'll do it with the full blessing of Bandit. But in Kentucky, the Democrats like having a governorship. And
but let me tell you something else, James, because I agree. Andy Beshear, I think, is one of the four or five most attractive, and I hate this term, but viable Democratic potential candidates in 2028. And so, yeah, I'd love him to win a Senate seat, but he is not a second rate, presidential candidate at all. And so I think if he wants to, he will elevate the field if he runs for president.
Absolutely. And let me tell you, the other thing he's done, he's made Kentucky a little safer for Democrats because, you know, they want to believe this Dakota Indian lunacy drives the Democratic Party. He's shown quite convincingly another way. I kind of hope he runs, in one sense, if he runs for president, he's going to elevate the field. It's going to make everybody better. He's going to be damn good. You're not going to get away with anything with him on the stage. And, you know, usually when you run for president, you kind of know by March. And I'm sure he had plenty of time to qualify for the United States Senate if his presidential run fills it up. I'm not saying it will. And I think he's a very valuable person we want on that stage, for sure.
Yep, absolutely. Okay. All right. Keep those letters and questions coming in. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll get to it next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following the episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our recent sponsors in our past episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it's what makes this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go and take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.